Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Apologize for the slight delay here. We're going to start with a public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2964. We've got a couple of state legislators here, Senators Dembro and Thompson. Let's do a quick briefing on this first.
I always see people sitting.
I know.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2964. We do have a dash one amendment as well. I'll get to that in just a second. But the underlying bill is it's making changes to an existing property tax exemption that is made available. It's commonly referred to as the new single-unit housing property tax exemption. And what it is, the existing one, is it's a 10-year exemption for newly constructed property that's being used as a dwelling for one person or a family, and it's rented at a value of less than or equal to, or excuse me, the value is less than or equal to 120% of the median sales price of dwelling units within the city. It is a permissive property tax exemption, so there are allowances for cities to adopt more stringent program requirements. The changes in 2964 is that it's adding newly purchased or rehabilitated property to the list, not just the newly constructed. And then the dash one is just applying the existing sunset law to the program to the new changes as well. So the newly purchased or the rehabilitated property will also be scheduled to sunset January 1st, 2025, which was not contained in the underlying introduced measure that moved through.
Okay, Senators.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll start. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, and happy to be here with my good colleague from Hood River and East Multnomah County, Senator Thompson. This bill, as it was described to you by staff, may have sounded familiar to you, rung a faint bell, because a couple of months ago we came and presented you a bill, Senate Bill 827, which did this exact same thing. But it was one of these situations where there were parallel, identical bills in both chambers. The one on the House side went to the Human Services and Housing Policy Committee, and then to their Revenue Committee, and then to the floor where it passed 53-5. And as was described, what it does is it takes an existing program to encourage home ownership, to facilitate home ownership through a tax exemption vehicle that is permissive on the part of the city, needs the support of the county to be able to do it. If that happens, it allows them to use this vehicle not just for newly constructed housing, but existing affordable housing. And housing for which there has been some public investment in improving it and turning it around, making it available for low-income home ownership. So it's a really important bill, and I think it's. I hope that we can pass this bill here in the Senate.
Chair Hassan, committee, thanks for having us today. My name is Chuck Thompson, representing District 26 and a portion of Multnomah County in Southeast Portland. Thanks for hearing this bill, House Bill 2964. And like you heard before, it's an identical bill we previously heard, 827. Like Senator Dembro, housing is very important in my district all over, and especially in Southeast Portland. The bill will allow the city to provide a similar tax, limited tax exemption for low and moderate income households. It also does for purchases an existing affordable home or whose home receives publicly funded home repair or rehab investments. I have submitted a technical 1-1 amendment, clarifies a January 1, 2025 sunset date for approval under this legislation, and thanks for considering the bill, and I urge you to approve House Bill 2964 with a dash one amendment. Thanks.
Questions of our two senators?
Oh, no, I'm ready to vote no issue notice or minority report. That's for Senator Thompson.
Yeah.
If he leaves, I might just be a yes vote.
Okay, I'll leave.
He's got baggage there.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
interpretation of the dash one.
Yeah. City of Portland, Dan Eisenbeis, Andrea.
Chair House, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning in support of House Bill 2964, as well as the Dash 1 amendment. This bill, as noted, is identical to Senate Bill 827, which was heard earlier this session, so we will keep our remarks fairly brief. The Dash 1 amendment is essentially a technical clarification that January 1, 2025 is the sunset date for approvals under this legislation. There is an existing January 1, 2025 sunset date for newly constructed homes. Legislative Revenue Office staff astutely noted that the way that that is crafted in existing statute is specific to newly constructed homes. So we're just seeking to clarify that a sunset applies to all approvals under this legislation. With me here this morning is Andrea Mathiasen from the Portland Housing Bureau. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Andrea Mathiasen, Portland Housing Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2964 this morning. The City of Portland has used the current statute to provide the benefits of homeownership to low and moderate income homebuyers in Portland in its current form since 2012. We do that in partnership with Multnomah County. As the statute allows, the City of Portland imposes additional requirements on the buyers and the sales price of these units. Statute allows for the sales price to go up to 120% of the median county sales price, which in Portland is $416,000. We have elected to require that units be affordable to a lower subset of our community, and so we require that sales price to be $350,000, which is 100% of the median county sales price. Eligible homebuyers must be 100% of area median income in order to receive that 10-year property tax exemption. The current statute requires that builders apply prior to pulling their permits. We're only able to approve this on newly constructed units. The next slide provides a little bit of context as to why in Portland the existing statute is no longer as effective as it has historically been in creating affordable homeownership opportunities. The numbers at the bottom half of the slide provide some context as to the increasing sales prices for units being approved under this program. You can see that over the past 5 years, those have gone from $231,000 to $287,000 on average. But the buyer income has not increased in scale. Additionally, we see fewer builders coming into the program. They are building homes that are larger, construction land costs are increasing, and they're electing not to build homes that meet our sales price cap of $350,000.
This slide kind of encapsulates the problem, doesn't it?
For us, it does.
Wages are stagnant and home prices go up and up.
Correct, yes. So House Bill 2964 would allow jurisdictions to expand the definition of eligible homes from newly constructed units to existing inventory. What Portland sees is that some of those existing units are more affordable to households, low and moderate income households. In addition, the expanded definition would allow jurisdictions to provide the 10-year tax exemption to low and moderate income households receiving publicly funded emergency home repair, weatherization, as an additional tool to help homeowners retain the homes that they have been able to access. Portland's implementation of this expanded definition would include rigorous compliance monitoring to make sure that the intended recipients are those actually getting the benefit of the 10-year tax exemption, and it would also be implemented in partnership and full support with Multnomah County. Thank you very much.
Can you give us some examples? We do better with hypotheticals up here, but in your case, some examples of how this would work. If I'm a, how does this work for somebody who's making $40,000 and I've got a family? How does this work for the developer? Walk us through one of your cases.
For a newly constructed homeownership unit? So a developer has a parcel of land. They have applied for permits. They apply to the city of Portland. We approve their application. We place a lien on their property. They have a certain number of months within to complete construction. And then before the city of Portland will remove that lien, we then receive an application from an income qualified buyer that requires approval as well before that property tax exemption moves forward.
Okay, now how does it work with the actual sales price? And how do you arrive at a price for that buyer?
So it is the sales price that at the time of closing at escrow. Generally, that equates to the appraisal as well.
I was only curious as a follow-up. I mean, we saw in the news that, you know, the appraisal has totally meaningless in the last month in Portland. They're saying, I mean, the newspaper's reporting that, you know, sales are actually vastly exceeding, you know, appraisals and present values. So in a program like this, how does that work? So if the house sells for, you know, $50,000, $60,000 above the appraised value and the asking price, how does that work in a program like this?
We do find that dynamic happening frequently with existing inventory. It happens less often with new constructed units coming in under this program, given the location, the size, the amenities that are being included in the units being developed.
Do you have an estimate, just curious, on the city of Portland, what the how much you lose in property taxes because of this, or how much property taxes you forego because of this per year?
So on an annual basis, also incorporating the taxes that go back onto the tax rolls in terms of compliance and expirations of the 10-year tax exemption, I think we estimate that to be a little under $3 million annually, given that the City of Portland has a 100-unit cap on the number of approvals that we will support annually.
Okay, and Dan, what's the status of the other bill, 827?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, so Senate Bill 827 is still sitting in this committee. That bill was heard approximately the same time that this House bill was being heard on the House side in committee there. And the committees on the House side essentially got to working the bill a little faster. And so they moved that over here. And
okay, so there's no problem with 827. It's just
being, no. They just... The two bills were identical, and committees in both chambers decided to hear the bills approximately the same time.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
See, I was smart enough to write the question down in ink and have Kyle answer it for me, not ask the stupid question in public. But I moved the -1 amendment dated 5/16/17 into the main bill.
Senator Boquist moves the -1 to House Bill 2964. Discussion? Objections? So ordered.
Move House Bill 2964 as amended by the -1 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2964 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bettinger?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Yep.
Pass votes aye. The measure goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation, and we will ask Senators Dembro and Thompson to carry it. They can figure that out. close a work session on that and open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2779.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2779 comes your way from your counterparts in the House, the House Committee on Revenue. House Bill 2779 has to deal with the financial management part of your portfolio. This primarily takes some of the statutes and the financial management of certain funds by the state treasurer and kind of puts some of these, first of all, it takes away one of the difficulties that the state treasurer and the DCBS also, which is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, used to kind of have these co-management or regulation of financial institution and takes a requirement of where the depository institution makes certain notifications and alerts and makes it more of the state treasurer type of function. It, however, allows for the director of DCBS to be notified or in consultation rather than direct notification. Now, also the bill takes the set of conditions for the collecting agencies for that come through the state treasurer and modifies the reporting requirement for the custodians of and depositories of public funds. The bill also went through an amendment while it was in the House, and part of the amendment is asked to create a work group appointed by the state treasurer relating to depositories of public funds. And the work group will be reporting back to the Revenue Committee or committees by the 2019 session. This amendment also takes out the these requirements of the 24-hour quick notice or quick delivery of funds to the treasurer. Takes that requirement out for counties, and this was the amendment, the work group that was put together between the counties, the state treasurer, and DCBS to come up with these financial requirements. So that's what 2779 does for you.
Okay, Chelsea Broussard from the treasurer's office.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Broussard. I'm the policy director at the Oregon State Treasury. I have some testimony from Cora Parker, who's the director of finance at the Oregon State Treasury, that outlines what the bill does. This housekeeping bill primarily addresses two distinct issues related to the administration of public funds, as well as directs Treasury to convene a work group related to public funds. The first issue, the sections amending provisions of ORS 293-265 relates to how quickly state funds are deposited with Treasury. That statute generally requires that all funds collected or received by state agencies or their agents be deposited within one business day. An exception for a reasonable longer period exists for agencies that collect or receive funds themselves. The amendments extend this reasonable longer period exception to agents, including counties and other public entities, that collect public funds on behalf of state agencies. While several longstanding business practices and contractual relationships have extended this exception to agents, More recent legal advice raised questions about whether that is truly permissible under the law. This bill would clarify that the reasonable longer period exception applies to all agents. For example, under the statute, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has agreements with counties to issue various permits and collect various fees on behalf of DEQ. Such agreements were entered into based on prior legal guidance and provide a convenience to the customer in addition to driving administrative efficiencies. Changing such business practices would most likely negatively impact administrative efficiencies and could trigger costs associated with implementing new service delivery models. Some agents may even be unable to adapt to systems and processes, forcing agencies to sever relationships with some agents. Treasury generally believes that through appropriate contractual arrangements, including required adherence to ORS Chapter 295 and designation of agency funds in accounts clearly designated on behalf of the agency partner, the reasonable longer period exception can be extended to agents. Adoption of the bill will clarify that current business practices, previously implemented in good faith, in fact meet the requirements of the statute, while failure to adopt may put such practices at risk. The second issue relates to public funds collateralization program, with the bill amending various provisions of ORS Chapter 295. Several of those provisions, particularly those relating to specific and detailed division of duties and actions among custodians, depositories, Treasury, and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, conflict with longstanding practices. Current statutes assign roles and responsibilities across the various entities at an overly detailed level. In several cases, those roles and responsibilities may make sense on paper but are impractical in execution. Notably, several of the conflicts were brought to our attention while processing a recent change in custodian. For example, ORS 295-013 currently directs custodians to monitor whether depositories' pledged collateral falls below minimum collateral requirements. However, Treasury is responsible for calculating minimum collateral requirements based on reports submitted by depositories to Treasury, and custodians are required to report collateral information to Treasury. Based on current rules and practices, Treasury is the only entity in possession of the information needed to actually monitor compliance with this requirement and is the entity that has historically performed the function. This bill is intended to align the statutes more directly with current practices or, in most cases, to bring the language to a policy level rather than a procedural level. Such an approach acknowledges that specific systems, processes, roles, and responsibilities could change over time and that such details are best addressed via pledge agreements or administrative rules. Amendments to the bill include direction to Treasury to convene a work group to comprehensively review the framework for how public funds are managed and protected across the state. Treasury requested that direction and recognition that existing law at times fails to contemplate and possess challenges to modern business practices pursued by both governments and private industry. The prescribed work group will ensure that various stakeholder groups are well represented and that the effort adequately incorporates varying perspectives. Adoption of the bill will allow for continuation of existing or necessary business practices while also setting the stage for future statutory changes that better align with modern business practices. Failure to adopt would require a change to our existing practices and the parties responsible for them, of which some changes would not be practicable. We appreciate your consideration of House Bill 2779A.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Thank you.
when I see this, I see a task force, and I see the word may here. So we're.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of summarize the problem in your own words?
Just of what the task force is.
What we're fixing here, what we're looking mm-hmm. at with this task force.
Yeah. So in current. In current law doesn't fully contemplate the sort of modern business practices related to automatic payments and electronic payments. And so this issue came about with an OLCC-related issue that they wanted us to fix in this current bill. We thought it best to not fix that specific issue and to look at how we could modernize our business practices related to collateralizing public funds while at the same time not putting those public funds in jeopardy, and thought that it would take a little bit longer than just, you know, a quick fix and quick amendment to the bill.
That was an excellent nutshell. That was perfect.
Thank you.
Questions? Senator Boquist.
Okay. I know you're not the one, so, but I'm grasping with, I'm very familiar with how we now do this manipulation in the Senate, where we don't call it a task force, we call it a work group. But right. I'm looking at the entire Section 8 here and trying to understand, mm-hmm. you've done a very good job of encapsulating the issue at hand, and it is the state treasurer's responsibility. But why do we need to tell the state treasurer to go do a work group that he already has the authority to do?
That's a great question. I'm not necessarily sure that we need to. We could convene a work group, but it would provide the state treasurer's office and provide our office some, I'm looking for the right word, but, you know, it would be great for bringing people to the table to actually discuss the issue and for coming back in a reasonable amount of time.
Some legitimacy.
Well, actually, just a statement more than that observation that I have in the question. And that is that, you know, sort of like my committee, the governor couldn't get people to come sit at the table even though she's the governor, and so we had to pass a state law directing them to go sit at the table with the governor, which I found rather ironic, and we just did that in this legislature. But it's sort of the same thing. I'm not sure we really need this. But here's my other question. The deputy state treasurer does not mm-hmm. sit on the Oregon Investment Council. There's nothing in the staff measures, and you didn't mention this. So why are we having the deputy state treasurer provide advice to the chairman of the Oregon Investment Council on what professional education they should have?
That's a great question. So the state treasurer's office is interested in having some continuing education requirements related to fiduciary duties for the Oregon Investment Council. It's something that a lot of other investment divisions in other states do, and it's something we're interested in doing on an ongoing basis.
Follow-up, Senator.
Well, you can take it back to Treasurer Reed and remind him that he is the one responsible, not the deputy, and the deputy doesn't sit on the Oregon Investment Council. And the Investment Council is, frankly, a pet peeve of mine, and I have blocked appointments to that council before. So I really think the state treasurer ought to be the one providing his professional counsel to the chairman of the investment council and deciding with the chairman what the best professional education is, not the deputy. So I'll be a no vote until it's amended, Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Boquist, just a quick follow-up. One of the reasons that we decided it would be best for the deputy state treasurer to do that is because the state treasurer actually sits on the Oregon Investment Council. And so we thought it best that someone outside of the Oregon Investment Council would be setting policy for the Investment Council as a whole.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, last time I checked, a deputy works for the treasurer. So therefore, I mean, that makes a great political statement, but it's not effective. And I do have a pet peeve on this particular entity, and so, and I do fully agree, but it is not the deputy that ought to be held accountable for the professional education. It's the chairperson and the state treasurer that ought to be held accountable. So I'm still a no vote until it's amended.
So the reason that the treasurer wasn't placed there is because he's also on the council, and it creates a situation.
Yes.
Right, Mr. Chair, the deputy works for the state treasurer and at the pleasure of the state treasurer. So. You mean, why don't we just call the ace and ace and spade and spade? I mean, it's the state treasurer and the chairman need to develop a plan between the two of them.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hatch. I just wanted to have you explain, there must be some sort of national standards, other states setting that they're following, right? I mean, it's setting to the professional requirements, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Or?
Sure, Senator Taylor. I don't know specifically and exactly what other standards other states have set. I can certainly get that information, but other states definitely have fiduciary requirements for their investment councils and required fiduciary trainings.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, I would just also met and would ask Mazen that when the Senate prepares its version of the staff measure summary, that we add this topic into it. It is not in the staff measure summary whatsoever. And it is actually a big bloody deal considering they're managing our money. So.
All right, we're going to let this breathe for a while. Maybe we'll at an amendment.
Okay. Happy to talk about it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chelsea. Close public hearing and work session on 2779. And let's dispatch of this bill that we were ready to go with the other day. Didn't have the paperwork, but I'll open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2150.
So, to refresh your memory, House Bill 2150 deals with the reports and payments to OLCC from the section of tax, the privilege tax on primarily beer and wine. This is not the distilled spirit section, which is a different way of taxation, but this is the privilege tax that is paid by the distributor, and it is actually levied on the manufacturers and importers of wine and cider and beer. So this would allow for them to be able to file their reports and forms that today are in statutes to be filed on paper. This allows them to do it online and pay their tax obligation electronically. As was mentioned in the last meeting, this has part of the process that needs to be done with the IT state process that kind of takes different steps, and it needs to figure out itself in the OLCC budget structure. So the amendment pushed the implementation until July 2019 in order to be able to accomplish those steps. Right. So that's that dash one amendment.
You ready, Mr. Chair?
I am.
I move the dash one amendment dated 5/19/17 into 2150. I'll speak to the amendment.
Senator Boquist moves the dash fives into House Bill
dash one.
I'm sorry.
Dash one.
I thought
dated
you said
5/19.
Okay, that's what gave me pause. Apologize. Yeah. Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into House Bill 2150. Is there any discussion, Senator Boquist?
Just very quickly, so for all of our colleagues to note, the issue that Mazin raised in terms of which I'm assuming it's OLCC or whomever, is because we have these legacy computer systems, which, you know, are written in language that, I mean, most of the people older than us, well, with one exception, okay, don't know anything about and can't write, but they can. But so the one exception to the good Senator Riley. The problem being here is our legacy systems, when we try to do a tax change, which we're finding in a wide spectrum right now, mm-hmm. is our computer systems just, it takes a year to reprogram to do simple changes. This is not the only issue. This is just an electronic form filing, but I just point out that we have a variety of other bills in which we're talking about doing tax changes, and it may take anywhere from a year to 2 years for those agencies to be able to implement that stuff. So many of the things we're complementing to get us in the 21st century, we have to drag our computer system out of the 18th century to get it where we're at. So.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Riley, you want to defend your honor here? I know you're a tech guy.
I could make this change in a month, Mr. Chair.
I think he's applied looking for a job.
He might be the one that goes out of
Further discussion on the dash ones? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, in the 19th century, there was no computers.
We and you speak from experience.
That is correct. There. I was there. I
Mr. Chair, I move 2150 as amended by the dash one to the floor with the two pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2150 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bachier?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Yes.
Chair Ass?
Ass votes aye. The measure goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. And we are back up to Senator Riley. Would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Riley will carry it. That closes out our agenda. Thank you all. We will be back with the joint committee tomorrow at 8:30. We are adjourned.